And the time is 4 o'clock. This is Community Radio. Stay tuned for Radioactive.
Welcome to Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal with hosts Meredith DeFrancesco and Amy Brown. Today we'll be talking with John Rensenbrink about race, justice, and the environment. Whether it's the Southwest Organizing Project in New Mexico fighting the toxic air pollution affecting low-income Latino communities by Intel, pesticide exposure of farm workers and their families across the country, the high asthma rates and other illnesses in the Bronx or in other urban centers, or the water pollution affecting the Penobscot and Passamaquoddy of Maine, people of color and low income have acutely felt the effects of environmental degradation. Does this continue to be under the radar? It is not an unknown discussion, studies and articles concluding that there is a correlation between location of environmentally hazardous facilities, factories and dumps, and the location of low-income minority housing. The siting of facilities in these communities of lesser political clout has been termed environmental racism or an issue of environmental justice. These issues are not just within these borders. The shipping of wastes to the location of factories in lesser developed countries is a trend that has visited health issues on the receiving populations. We have with us today John Rensenbrink on the phone today, and he will be talking with us about the dispelling of myths about the exclusionary nature of environmental concern and community action and the issue of health being separate from the issue of environmental health. We will also look at globalization in the context of these issues. John Rensenbrink of TOPSEM has been working towards a symposium on race, justice, and the environment for the past 2 years. He is a professor emeritus of government at Bowdoin College, the co-founder of the National Green Party and the Maine Green Party, and has been working on the green response to globalization. This February 22nd and 23rd, Bowdoin College will host the symposium on race, justice, and the environment. Welcome, John.
Hey, great to be here.
Great. Why don't we, before we get talking about the actual symposium, talk about these paradoxes, these myths that you have been focusing on, and I guess you can start wherever you want, but I know you speak about the idea of environment as just a concern of the upper class,
yes,
the natives' concerns, and health issues and globalization, so...
That certainly is true. The first one you mentioned, I think, is in some ways, well, the second one, too. I've got two there that stand out for me, for sure. The claim that environment is just a special interest of the upper middle class white people. The question you have to pose, then, is what are the environmental concerns of people of color, of the poor, and other members of society, including the rich, by the way. And that, it seems to me, is something that's lost. When economists, for example, have spoken that way, political scientists have spoken that way, it really irritates me, it irks me for years and years. And it's a myth that grabs hold and is one of the ways in which I think people are separated from each other. Another big myth is that those seeking environmental protection and restoration, they ignore the plight of the poor and the need for jobs, while those with social justice, uppermost in their minds, are insensitive to the environment. This cuts both ways, of course, and that's another issue that has been, I think, has been holding back both business and environmentalists, as a matter of fact, good business people, and also sensitive environmentalists. And what has happened is that there's been this intense dichotomizing, and therefore people are ranged against one another for, I think, not good reasons. And if we could get through, I feel, to dispelling some of these kinds of myths, I think we can help the whole process and gather people together who presently are at odds with each other. I could go on about the myths, for example, but maybe we ought to pause and you want to ask another question.
Oh, well, actually, you might continue on with this, and I just wanted to add, too, that possibly under the radar, too, are organizations specifically dealing with environmental justice issues and are bringing these two issues together, so it's not that it's not being done, but perhaps just not as talked about as much.
It's not, and yes, and I think a lot of times we all preach to each other as if to the choir, and there's not enough major mass media and politicians' concern, all of them still tend to think in terms of these dichotomies, jobs versus the environment.
Well, it seems that they not only think in those terms, but they encourage others to think in those terms. When you think
yes.
of who benefits
yes.
from
that's a real good question.
People being divided mm-hmm. And how that's promoted, that's mm-hmm. greatly promoted in any of the coverage that we've seen, even of the anti-globalization protests that have happened in the past mm-hmm. few years, which have included a much greater diversity than mm-hmm. some other large protests have in the past. That has not been focused on at all.
And also, you know, even the New York Times for years, this occurs to me right now, but have done studies and reported on studies made that 65-70% of the American people are willing to pay more taxes if the environment is going to be protected thereby. Does that emerge in terms of politicians' calculations? No. Does that emerge in terms of any kind of mass media attention to these things? No, not at all. So you begin to realize that there's another game in town going on here, which is according to what along the lines of what you're talking about. Let me tell you something else. Or,
please.
Describe something else. At a cultural level, also, you know, you get the whole notion that the environment is really a rural concern. It's not an urban concern. And that is so preposterously absurd. But at the same time, it's a very strong idea. I know it's true in Portland, Maine. I know it's true in Los Angeles. I know it's true. Even though you know, books like Bob Bullard has written, really tremendous. He's an African American scholar at Stanford University.
Yes.
And he has written a really good book about 6-7 years old now, but in which he details describes the environmental problems and incredible problems of pollution endured by people in the city, and most of them are, I think, as you mentioned, alluded to earlier. People who living in basically people of color neighborhoods and also poor neighborhoods, and that's where these incinerators, for example, are located. We're going to be showing a film Friday night, tomorrow night, that details that in Chester, Pennsylvania.
Where is the film going to be shown?
At Bowdoin tomorrow as part of our program.
Okay, great. Do you want to touch on some of the more of the myths that you've been discussing?
Well, I think also it's interesting about we're having Barry Dana, who's going to be talking tomorrow at the Common Hour.
The governor of the Penobscots.
Yes. And also Rebecca Sockbesson, who is the a person who is in charge of multicultural diversity at the University of Southern Maine, and she's also a member of the Penobscot Nation. But what occurs to me there is that and what's going on here is often that Native American concerns, their articulation of the relationship between human beings and nature, which is very profound and very immediate and very direct, and that often is taken as somehow or other that's something that happened before industrial society, but now that we have industrial society, that's a thing of the past. That kind of connection with nature, that immediate, sensuous awareness of all things as living beings, and that you owe something to them, or that's a relationship we have with all living beings, that should be at the forefront, it seems to me, of our cultural concern. And if it were, I think a lot of these other problems would be overcome.
In fact,
so I think the voices of people like Barry and Rebecca really need to be elevated and magnified throughout the culture.
I was just going to say a lot of Native communities throughout this country, as well as other countries, have been dealing specifically with environmental concerns that are impinging on their cultural
yes.
heritage and their health, including the case that's ongoing with the tribes here in Maine being sued by the paper companies for internal tribal documents that we covered quite a bit a while back on Radioactive, and it's. All three of the tribal governors are still facing contempt of court charges for refusal to turn them over. But when they were here speaking with us, one of the things that has stuck in my mind that Governor Dana was talking about was that he has been really encouraging the young people on Indian Island to try to stay in touch with their cultural heritage, particularly in terms of using medicinal plants that, he'd been taught to use by his grandparents, and that they actually have to not do that at the Penobscot River anymore. He has to take the kids to another river that doesn't have the paper companies upstream.
That's right.
So that they can practice their cultural heritage. So we talk about
Rebecca's going to talk about that Saturday as part of the panel on the politics of the political dimensions of race, justice, and the environment. We're showing a film tomorrow night, also side by side with the other film I was mentioning about Chester, Pennsylvania. This film is Drumbeat for Mother Earth, which Rebecca Sogbesson has had a lot to do with producing, and it's been shown to the United Nations. It's a wonderful 57-minute documentary of the PCB problem in Native American communities, not only in the United States, but also in Latin America.
Let's talk about health, the idea of health that...
Yes, I figured you were coming to that. That's really a favorite of mine also.
Yeah.
The whole way in which we tend to... I think in some ways the fact that we think of health over here in one compartment and the environment over there in the other compartment, we really don't see the connections, because I think this may be, this is a psychological and philosophical point I'm going to make, but I really think it has something to do with a cultural failure in the West and maybe in the East as well in terms of the body-mind split, you know? I mean, the body is something that is separate from the mind, and because of that split, we think of so readily that when with our minds we're thinking of the environment out there, right? And but we don't realize that the environment is our body. All the things that go on in our bodies are part of the environment. What we eat and what we drink and what we breathe, all of those are very immediate. And every person in the world, in that sense, is an environmentalist, whether they know it or not, because they carry in their bodies the marks of what we're doing to the environment.
Do you feel there's enough studies out there showing these sort of connections, or has that been
not enough.
A neglected part of...
It's a very neglected thing. And Annette Dula, who's one of the speakers, she's an African-American person from Tuskegee and does a lot of consulting. And she has chapter and verse, story after story, about issues of race interrelate here in terms of hospitals, in terms of how people are treated, which brings up, on the one hand, the racial disparities and discrimination that take place, but also what's underneath that, it seems to me, is this disjunction in our minds and in our culture between body and mind.
Well, it's also really hard to get funding to do the research that, first off, in terms of doing research, we know that dioxin, PCBs, mercury, that these things have health effects. But in terms of finding out exactly how much there is in certain ecosystems, finding someone to fund that is very difficult. Most funding that's done at universities for research these days is corporate underwritten, or large part of it. And so who's going to fund the very expensive tests? Like for dioxin, it's very difficult to just, you can't just go out and buy a dioxin test kit at your local hardware store. So finding the funding to actually do that without involving either the government or the corporations that may have a stake in it not
difficult.
Being researched.
And
right.
What occurs to me while you're talking is the whole issue of Velpar, which certainly is a huge issue in the blueberry fields and has been for years. And I know in testimony several years ago when we were in Augusta, Nancy Allen and myself and others, and we were able to draw on information that we had from Centers for Disease Control, which showed that from their studies that Velpar may or may not be a carcinogen. It can't be said that it is not. It can't definitely be said that it is. That's as far as they were able to go. Now, on the one hand, you can criticize the Centers for Disease Control for not really being a little bit on top of the mark there. But even in terms of the way in which they presented it, what is incredible is that large corporations will go ahead and produce this, and governments will go along with allowing it to be distributed and used in the absence of any clear indication that it will affect people.
Yeah, it's innocent until proven deadly.
So what happens really is that people are thought of as an afterthought, and they become really the guinea pigs for the use of these very highly suspicious and possibly carcinogenic And, of course, in the event you discover that they are carcinogenic. So the answer to that that's been given by a lot of people who are experts in this is that what we need worldwide, but also nationally and statewide, we need the precautionary principle. And the precautionary principle is that you don't use something unless it's definitely shown to be okay. You don't go ahead and use it and see whether or not the effects are what you worry they might be.
Do you think there's a real movement towards adopting the precautionary principle in any facet, right?
Well, I think we're going to go to Johannesburg with that, and that's for sure. Johannesburg is going to be 10 years after Rio. Mm-hmm. It's going to be happening in late August. And I think the non-governmental organizations of the world and the Green Parties are sort of going to be bringing that really strongly to the councils.
So that's the basic concept, that people's health takes precedence over corporations' right to use whatever chemicals based on lack of information.
And when you think of 60 or 70,000 chemicals out there, and many of them have not been tested, of course the hue and cry in terms of applying the precautionary principle, they're closer to it in Europe than we are here. But I really think that it's beginning to be seen. I'm beginning to read about it more all the time, that people are claiming that this is really the only guideline, that this is the only way in which we can effectively begin to get some kind of control of what is now out of control.
Let's talk about globalization.
And, it's a good segue.
Yes. And I know we actually saw an example at home with the mercury from Holter Chem being slated to move to India to a plant there where certainly environmental regulations are much less, but that this, not necessarily new trend, but continuing trend to locate facilities and dump in lesser developed countries. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about that a little bit in the perspective of environmental racism?
It goes on, it just goes on all the time.
Yep.
This film I'm talking about, we're going to be showing in Chester, Pennsylvania, these folks, African-American community, they found that this incinerator was planted right down in the middle of their place, their habitation. And they had a heck of a time figuring out first, because they got sick, and the cancer rates increased.
It's actually been documentation many times of the increased health.
And then they tried to find out who was doing this to them. And they certainly went to the city hall and stuff like that. They eventually discovered that much of the waste, the hospital waste of the state of Pennsylvania was being brought there. And they finally went to the state legislature and the governor and discovered, went to the Supreme Court, and discovered that the chief person in the Supreme Court was the brother of the guy who was in the corporation, heading the corporation that was doing it to him. Mm. So it took them a long time to discover that. And whether or not they ever succeeded in getting that changed, the film does not say. I haven't been able to check up whether they were successful or not. But the film is a really, Late Waste is a really shocking and sensitive piece of work. And you can just chapter and verse of that all over the world. Of course, a place like China, the Chinese government is beginning to realize that they have really done some really, really serious devastation to their people. There's a huge coal burning operation. They have a lot of coal, and the air is so amazing. The cancer rates are galloping upwards. And they're beginning to realize that the environmentalists in their midst are people to be listened to. But it's just beginning. I mean, this kind of thing is going on all over the world. It doesn't matter what kind of regime you have, whether it's a capitalist regime or a communist regime.
Well, the thing that's important for people to know, I think, about globalization is that it doesn't matter. I mean, what kinds of things people try to get together and do to prevent what corporations are doing to the environment under the globalization, global trade policies, what that would allow is that any country could contest another country's laws if they interfered with trade. So giving examples of internally either laws not being in place or laws not working or politicians being corrupt or influenced. Even with that, the system that we do have existing,
well, the WTO
would be weakened or just completely dismantled.
The World Trade Organization is going to be another big subject at Johannesburg.